on Blog Talk Radio that time
on a Wednesday at 8 p.m. on the blogtalkradio.com/. You have reached the K. Thompson Live Show. I am the son, so known as Eric Payne. Welcome to the show. I'm going to be starting off the show in a little bit. Or starting off now, my mom's going to be joining us a little bit, as will Wayne Gilmer be calling in. And we're going to be talking about the week's previous news and events. Certainly a lot going on in the world of politics, the world of foreign affairs and news all over the world. Obviously, the most recent thing that happened in the last week is the Trump ongoing series, the saga of the campaign of Donald Wild Man Trump. He's wild. He's a wild guy. But you got to think, I think that he's, after all is said and done, really, you got to look, when you look at things from an objective standpoint, this guy is really building his brand, the Trump brand. Everything, you know, all of this outlandish behavior has got him something like, I think the number was like $1 billion worth of advertisement and media access on every day. Everybody's talking to him, not really trying to grill him too much. Some reporters are now, but branding-wise, for people who like the Trump brand, I think after this, and who knows, he might have run for president just to build his brand. You know, there's a movie called Brewster's Millions, right? Old Richard Pryor movie. And the concept of the movie was that Richard Pryor, from a distant relative, stood to inherit, his character stood to inherit $300 million. But there was a catch. The caveat was that the great uncle said, but I'm going to leave you $30 million. You have to spend that all in the course of 1 month without receiving any assets, having any assets. And, of course, at the end of this 30 days, if you're able to do that, then you will stand to inherit $300 million. And said, if not, you can take the 30 and just call it a day or whatever, or take $1 million or whatever and call it a day. But that was the challenge to Richard Pryor's character. So he was trying to do all these things to waste money and not have any assets. And you know, he had put his friends in place, you know, doing different things. I mean, he was a minor league baseball player, so he just kind of had this kind of happenstance life trying to be a athlete. And so, you know, his friends started making some money for him a little bit, and it was driving him crazy. So he finally got the idea to run for political office, to run for mayor of New York. And he knew that way he would spend all his money and tank the election, basically, and stood to inherit this money. So I wonder if kind of that's the Trump concept a little bit, not that he stands to inherit, obviously, a larger amount of money, but to build the Donald Trump brand, because that brand now, everybody all over the world is talking about it, probably the most exposure that he's had ever, more so than when he first came out, you know, with his books and Atlantic City Properties and The Apprentice, now running for president, saying all the crazy things. I'm sure his brand is really is worldwide. The whole thing is the drawback to that is what is the impression of his brand. Is his brand negative? You know, everybody knows him, but does everybody know him to be a jerk? Or does everybody know him to be an okay guy? And apparently he's okay to a number of his supporters. And it's really, you know, to that kind of not too, I don't think there are some of them. Clearly, it's the facts are not too intelligent. In my estimation, I mean, that's a fact that it's said that a lot of people were not college educated. But also, I think that a lot of these people are just blinded with hatred. There's a certain segment, not all of his supporters, but clearly there's a certain large enough segment that seem to be blinded by hatred more than anything else. And if you look at the news this week where his campaign manager, his staffer, this guy, I forget his name, Ladowski or whatever, pulled this reporter, and now he's been charged with a simple battery or whatever. And just if you watch how they're trying to spin it, and particularly Donald Trump, who kind of always goes for the jugular, full speed out, no concept of what's right, you know, what's proportional. Just kind of, you know, going and saying that maybe this woman would have pulled me. If she would have pulled me, should I have? I mean, really, just this is an individual that never backs down, never has a moment of self-reflection, never even thinks that he might be mistaken or that anybody besides him knows at all. And so his campaign manager or campaign close campaign staffer was charged with this simple assault, and they've been showing this tape here, and you can clearly see that the woman's motion, her body, her movement, her body momentum is changed, the direction is changed by some other force. It's physics. And she's pulled. This guy did pull her. He didn't brush by her like they are trying to say, because this woman's whole body direction kind of changes. And no, she didn't fall on the ground. No, it wasn't a great thing, but you can't really tell to which how much force it exactly was. We do know that it wasn't enough force to knock her down or do anything like that. And you know, you got to look at it objectively. Just because you hate Trump, you can't say his guy pulled her and knocked her down. But he also did lie when he said he never even met the lady. So, you know, people should look at these things for their own, and for their own, and take it, use their own judgment when you see this, because clearly, they have no qualms about lying, Donald Trump and his whole crew, and they have a certain amount of gangsterism that they approach things with. So I think that I have our other co-host on the line, Mr. Wayne Gilman. Wayne, welcome.
Hey, good evening, Eric and company. How's everyone?
How you doing? How are you tonight?
Okay.
Just sitting here talking about the Donald Trump situation, particularly in particular the whole situation, you know, with the guy
on abortion. His bodyguard.
The campaign staffer, not bodyguard, who pulled.
Right.
Now, let me get your thoughts on that. The abortion issue, I just saw something about that. I'm not quite as up on that. He's trying to change his stance on abortion. Is that correct?
Pretty much. The thing is, he's held true to his opinion that he's against it, except in instances of rape and incest. But it's just a cavalier attitude that this man has. I hope every woman heard him today, that what he felt that initially, of course, he's changed his tune since then, that he felt that every woman who undergoes an abortion needs to be punished. You know,
oh,
I mean, he just came out with
said.
That statement. He said that on MSNBC this afternoon. And, I mean, it just caught on like wildfire. It was the lead story for many of the networks, and understandably so. He's a loose cannon. He needs somebody to edit his script before he speaks.
No. We don't want anybody to edit nothing. We want the people to hear exactly how he rolls. This guy's nuts. He just says whatever comes off the top of his head. He's not intelligent. And it's surprising that people actually are following this. We know what that's about. It's a national. It's a call to nationalism. It's a call to taking back America and all those people that feel that they've been left out, or America, they're losing their grip or their standing, are appealing to them. And I saw in the news earlier today that there was a guy, a white guy, said he was leaning. He was between Trump and Bernie Sanders, and he was leaning toward. You know, he went to see Bernie. He went to Bernie's rally. You know, saw it, and as he was describing it, it was kind of a calm atmosphere, diverse crowd. Mm-hmm. And then he went to the Trump rally and saw that there was mostly white people, pretty much all white people. It was pretty an exclusive type crowd. It wasn't a welcoming. He didn't feel welcome, and he said kind of the energy that he felt was not a welcoming, inclusive energy, but an exclusive energy.
Exactly.
And it was pretty much all white. He said after being there, he decided he was going to go for Bernie. He went there with open mind to really see what Donald Trump was about and judge for himself. But he said just the feeling was that, no, he was, you know, it's not a winning strategy of where America is going to go in the future to be exclusive and not include the other minorities or races. We're joined by the one and only Judge Benitez, Wilfredo Benitez, is going to join us talking and giving his perspective on, obviously, he has an opinion on politics and the law, being a judge, municipal judge in East Orange, and just recently going to be a municipal judge in Bellevue. Congratulations to you, a graduate of Rutgers Law School, undergraduate of Columbia University. Very astute gentleman, and I can say this firsthand because I know him very well, and he happens to be my brother-in-law, but he is a very accomplished gentleman a history maker, first Hispanic judge in the city of East Orange. Wilfredo Benitez, welcome to the show. Kicked off the live show, Wilfredo.
Thank you for having me, everyone. Thank you, Eric. I really appreciate
good
that.
Good evening.
How you doing, Wayne? Nice to talk to you again.
All right. Yeah, same here, same here. How's everything? And congratulations, by the way. Belatedly.
Everything. I appreciate that. You know, everything, all the opportunities I get, I really look forward to it. It gives me an opportunity, really, just to get back. As you know, municipal court is the core first level of the court system, so I really get a chance to affect change. So I really am thankful to the city of East Orange and Bellevue for giving me that opportunity. So I thank you for welcoming me.
Great.
Well, I want to spin off on that just as we talk, because you said the municipal court is really a chance where you get to make a difference. And that's really, you know, it's kind of like what's going on within the states, legislatures, where at that level, a lot of these Republicans have been making these derogatory laws, you know, they're trying to cut back on voting rights and things like that. And it's at levels like that, the municipal level, the state, the county level, the state level, where you can affect serious change. And the type of cases you were telling me about one day where, you know, kids might be doing certain things that other judges or in other places of the country would land them in jail with serious records, where you try to kind of balance it out and help a lot of kids who might be going the wrong way and kind of give them that chance that they wouldn't normally get. And let's be honest, they wouldn't normally get because they might be black or brown. And we need people at those levels, the level you're at, Wilfredo, to do that, and you to talk about your philosophy behind that.
First of all, Eric, you're dealing with this correctly and right on point. Look, as a municipal court judge, as I said, I get a chance to deal with 90% of the people who ever deal with the court system, because most of us are not dealing with indictable offenses. So it's not like we're going to Superior Court or anything like that. We're dealing with municipal court, which is the first rung, as particularly in the state of New Jersey, the court system that you deal with. And to your point, absolutely, I find that one of my core responsibilities, whenever I get opportunities, to give people an opportunity to get themselves together, avoid records if we can. And you mentioned something that's really dear to me, having grown up in the city, in New York City, Harlem, dirt poor, mother who raised four boys. You know, I think it's particularly important for people like myself, brown, black judges, to really reach back and give these young kids an opportunity to get their lives together. Oftentimes, you know, I see kids in East Orange being dealt with ordinances that they've violated, you know, loitering in front of a public place. Well, if you consider that, the public place is their background, it's their playground. They don't have backyards or garages like my kids do who are being raised in Montclair, right? So, you know, we took away the YMCA, who took away their abilities to go to a place where they can play basketball, what have you. So go battle different. A lot of these kids are on the streets, and I think it's unfair to then give them tickets for loitering and things of that nature. So, yes, or to the extent that I can, whether it be drug offenses, whether it be loitering offenses, what have you, I try my best to kind of balance the scale. Go battle different or indifferent, I find that I'm basically unique in that I do take or bring to bear my experience, my background, how I grew up, and I think it's only right to kind of balance the scales of justice, if you will, by giving these kids an opportunity to walk out of court with a clean record, or an opportunity to come back to court having proven to me they've done the right thing for 6 months, and then we go from there. So absolutely, Eric and Wayne, I take that responsibility seriously. I feel that it's just one of the lifetime opportunities to really affect change, and that's one of the core ways I can do that. So, yes, I take that very seriously.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. I just wanted to ask a quick question.
Before you get there, go ahead. I wanted to talk about after this, what type of offense you see in municipal court, because we don't want people to think that you're kind of, you know, helping people to get off or giving them breaks on serious crimes.
No, absolutely.
Court. Things that that you can affect some sort of social justice. So, Ben, Wayne, and
yeah, my question is along those lines. I guess it must be frustrating when you see, you know, a lot of, you know, our people and other people of color who have been victimized by the system. Where do you think that, you know, there should be some effort on the part of government to, you know, correct some of these ills? I mean, where should that begin?
Well, I mean, you know, that's an excellent question, but it has to – look, I have a personal affinity thing here to wanting to do the right thing, right? Because at the end of the day, Wayne, Eric, it's about doing the right thing. So let's talk frankly. Look, we have kids who are doing bad things at times. And just to clarify something, I am dealing with cases where, you know, the most I can put someone in jail is for 6 months. So I'm not dealing with indictable offenses. I'm not in Superior Court. I'm not in, you know, in the New Jersey Supreme Court. I'm in the first one. The most I can put anyone in jail would be for 6 months. I'm dealing with domestic violence. I'm dealing with drug cases. I'm dealing with truancy. I'm dealing with things of that nature, right? So to your point, I mean, look, the system speaks for itself. I think there are times when it's just not fair, as I indicated. You know, I bring to bear, I know that my kids, right, who are being raised in Montclair, if they wanted to do something, Wayne, they can go to their backyard, hide in their basement, do whatever. Unfortunately, kids who are in the city, whether it be East Orange, Orange, what have you, they don't have that same luxury, right? They come out to the streets. Their backyard is, you know, Main Street. Their backyard is Central Avenue, what have you. So, you know, what I try to bring to bear is, look, whether if I'm dealing with a police officer, if I'm dealing with a prosecutor, if I'm dealing with a public defender, I say, let's look at this kid, please. Let's look at his history. This is a kid who's going to school. This is a kid who, look, he made a mistake hanging out with his friend. But for the most part, a good kid, right? So we try to do the right thing. Wayne, that's what I'm doing. Look, I take what I do very seriously. I'm not, you know, bending the laws unnecessarily to, you know, to favor people who may look like me. But those occasions, Wayne, when I get a chance to kind of even the playing field, I do it in a way that makes sense, but only with the support of the prosecutor, only with the support of the public defender. You know, I bring in the police officer. I bring them to the table. I say, guys, what we can do to make this a little different from this kid, who's generally a good kid, may have made a bad mistake, right? So that's what I try to do. And to Eric's point, I'm not dealing with indictable offenses. I can never put someone in jail beyond a year. As I said, the most I can ever put someone in jail for 6 months. So, you know, I treat it for what it's worth, and to extend out in effect, I absolutely do that. But I feel it's my duty to do that, Wayne. Look, I grew up in Third Point, Harlem. If I hadn't gotten the chances that I'd gotten, there's no way that I'd be here speaking to you about anything good that I'm doing, right? Because I think we all would agree it could be one mistake for landing in jail, one mistake for making a mistake that could have cost the college or what have you, and I'm no different. So when I talk to these kids, and when I talk to these parents, when I talk to domestic violence issues, I say to them, what are we doing? Are we serious? And oftentimes when you talk to people like that, you kind of put them on guard, and they look at you and say, well, yeah, here's a judge who kind of looks at me and, more importantly, feels the way I feel. I get more results like that. So to the extent that I can, I try to even the playing field, not bending justice, not doing anything. Because quite candidly, we do have kids who probably are better served doing some time, right? So they can get sometimes hard lessons are the best lessons. But mostly kids just need a chance. And to the extent that I can do that, I do.
And also, right. I wanted to say, you know, it would be the same for any kid. It's not exclusive to black and brown people. If a kid happened to be white and he came in there and he met, you know, was a good kid basically and just got to some trouble, you would deal with him the same way. It's just at the point we all know, and anybody who doesn't address the fact or face the fact that justice has been dispensed a little bit more harshly on people of color, you're not dealing with the facts. So what you're trying to do is address that or at least be cognizant of that. And also, too, for those lay people like us, what are the type of offenses that a municipal court judge that would come before you as a municipal court judge? Just let people know that.
No, that's a good question. So primarily I'm dealing with traffic offenses, right? So whether it be moving violations, you know, red lights, what have you. So that's a good amount of the cases I deal with. I'm dealing with domestic violence cases. I'm dealing with disorderly person cases, whether it be drug offenses, loitering cases, wandering with the intent to purchase or sell drugs. And I'm dealing with a lot of truancy, which arguably is the thing I care about the most, right? I care about the fact that we have young kids who are coming into my courtroom having missed, Wayne, Eric, months, 6 months out of a year in just a school. I just can't fathom that a kid will come into my courtroom not appreciating what people have done before us, whether it be Thurgood Marshall, whether it be Martin Luther King, what have you. It's amazing to me that even today when we have kids who do not appreciate what people have done before him to make sure that we can vote, make sure that we can go to school, get an education. So when I get those opportunities, I tend to bring a kid into my chambers and speak to them. But in terms of what I do, you know, domestic violence, traffic offenses, disorderly person offenses, things of that nature. But to your point, Eric, oftentimes, you know, whether it be East Orange or other municipalities I sit, you know, you do have kids who are not from the neighborhood, primarily white kids who will come in and buy drugs. And I say to them, look, you know, you are like if I went to Montclair or had kids going to Montclair to purchase drugs or what have you. We do care about quality of life. And so to those kids, I say to them, don't want to see you again in my courtroom. Look, you see me outside, say hi to me. Do not want to see you in my courtroom because you stick out like a sore thumb. Like, we know who you are. We know what you're doing. Don't come to this neighborhood doing that. So it goes both ways. I can teach a kid in East Orange to, hey, listen, you can stay in school, try to do the right thing. And I can teach a kid in Montclair, don't bring your nonsense to this municipality because we also care about the quality of life here for our citizens. So it goes both ways.
Right. You're kind of really telling them not to contribute. You're telling the kids who are selling the drugs, don't contribute to this, to bringing down the quality of life where you live, and also the kids that might be coming from other areas. Don't bring down the quality of life by coming in here and contributing to this commerce.
Exactly.
You know, and that's what needs to be done. We know that the disparity in sentencing that was initiated years ago with crack cocaine and powder cocaine, that's a perfect example of that. Harsher justice on black and brown people because they were doing a lot of them predominantly were doing it, had crack offenses as opposed to the white collar powder sniffing people who were really kind of getting off light. So, you know, it's good to have that balance. I mean, the justice system in the United States has been built on the backs of the black and brown people and keeping down minorities. And as time has gone on, obviously, we've been able to kind of correct that a little bit. But it's very, very important that people be in the infrastructure.
Of course.
At these various levels, the cogs and the wheel that make government and make things turn, you know. It makes me think about when they want to, a lot of the government or, you know, when the president wants to put forth a budget about infrastructure spending and let's put a line item for infrastructure to build the roads and the bridges and this and that, and you have some Republicans wanting to cut back on the infrastructure, cut back on government employees' wages and things like that. If you go to D.C. and if you go to a lot of municipalities, you'll see that that's one of the places where there's very little discrimination working for the government. So when you go to the Capitol, you'll see a lot of black people that work in the Capitol building, working at the post office, working here, working there, and working as government employees. So what happens when these people want to talk about, you know, come down on government employees getting paid for nothing, it's almost like they're kind of, you know, you kind of know who they're talking about. It's not the politicians they're talking, they want to take money from or take opportunities from. It's those people that are working, the rank and file people who basically are considered blue collar workers, or a little bit more than, you know, obviously blue collar workers that work. You know, when you go to a municipality, the people of the clerk and that work in City Hall or these various places. So when these guys want to talk about government spending is too much, you know, you need government to regulate things. And the privatization theory of the Republicans is that, you know, private industry and business will take care of it. And the marketplace will draw it out. But if you get these people like they've been doing, fixing the market, and they're ripping people off, you have to have recourse. You have to have an entity to be able to go to and say, regulate this.
Sure.
If we didn't, that's why the president's trying to move with health insurance industry, because what happens is you have the potential for jerks like that CEO of that pharmacy company to raise the price on a drug that people are relying upon to live, to survive, and to raise it 3,000% with a smirk on your face and say that's what, you know, so that's what government can do. That's what regulation can do. And if you listen to the other side, they would have you to believe that regulation, all regulation is bad. And all regulation is not bad, just like too much regulation it is bad, can have a tendency to do that. So
you raise a good point. And for obvious reasons, I don't want to get too political because I am understanding that. If you look at what's happening now, whether it be, particularly on the Republican side with respect to the presidential race, what we're seeing now is years upon years about the disrespect that President Obama had to endure from the Republicans. I mean, President Obama couldn't pass, a bubblegum ordinance without being fought tooth and nail by the Republicans. I mean, you know, whether it be the Tea Party, whatever group came out of the Republican Party, now we're seeing the disrespect manifest itself in someone like Donald Trump. And it's almost as, you know, now the Republicans are seeing, look, this is what you've been doing to our president all these years, and they don't like it. I mean, so
turn inward.
So, I mean, you know, what I enjoy about what I do is that I'm trying to do the right thing. There are tons of municipal court judges doing the same, white and black, good, bad, and different. And we have to change mindsets. You know, when I come across a kid, I'm trying to teach them, look, you know, if you look around, see what's going on, they are building jails for you. They're not building new schools. They're building jails for you. And, you know, a kid, put them in a situation where he gets to think, they look at me and say, oh, that's a good point. I want to be a part of that. So anytime I can affect change and get people to think, you know, think seriously about their future and the neighborhood they live in and society, you can make some, we really can score some good points just by just pointing out the obvious. But, you know, some of the things that are going on with government, it's just interesting. You know, you have a president who tries to do the right thing, whether it be through, you know, health care, whether it be through trying to raise the minimum wages, whether it be trying to stabilize courts. And, you know, he was for tooth and nail, and it's too bad. Now we see a situation where the Republicans kind of lost control, lost their party, and they give rise to someone like Donald Trump. It's pretty interesting to me. But you didn't have to be a rocket scientist to see that coming.
Well, I think it's an embarrassment, personally. I just, every time I hear this man speak, and to think that they're world leaders, they're diplomats, and they're going to the United States government on different levels and expressing their intimate concern about the likelihood of this man becoming the next leader of the free world. You know, I just think it's despicable, but, you know, maybe he'll self-destruct. But, Judge Benitez, I wanted to ask you something. You mentioned something about jails, and it just triggered something a while, and I spoke to Kay earlier about this. We have a case here in New York that the Brooklyn District Attorney, Ken Thompson, is getting a lot of whiplash. First time that a person of color has held a seat as Brooklyn DA.
Right.
There was a shooting in a housing project. And I don't know if you have many cases of alleged police misconduct, but an Asian-American police officer, a rookie, you know, I don't know if you're familiar with the story where he shot a black kid in a hall.
Housing project, shot a young black kid. I know the story well. Yeah, and
right. Now
what? In terms of punishment, they're offering probation as opposed to jail time. And obviously the victim's family and a lot of folks think that's a slap in the face. So I'm well versed on that story, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, what's your take? I mean, if you were faced with something like that.
Well, in municipal court, I wouldn't necessarily deal with those cases. Maybe one day I get elevated to Superior Court where I have to deal with cases like that. I mean, here's the interesting thing. A lot of it, Wayne, as you know, is depending on the prosecutor's recommendations to the court, right? So certainly you have to take that to bear. I think that some of the heat that he's taken is well-deserved. You have a, you know, good, bad, or different. You have an officer who committed a wrong and to suggest, and remember, more importantly, a life has been lost. So to suggest probation, you know, I can understand the feeling where, you know, black lives doesn't matter. Like, there's a guy who lost his life, did nothing wrong, you know, arguably, you know, now they're talking about it should have been better lighting in the housing park, what have you. But at the end of the day, you had a rookie cop who obviously was ill-prepared to deal with that situation, was nervous, was scared, and shot someone and killed somebody. Personally, I don't believe probation is appropriate. I think, quite candidly, there are messages to be sent. You know, sometimes when you're dealing with a case, it's not just about the case. You have to send a message to society. I think if they were to give that guy probation, they'll be sending the wrong messages. But as for me, I don't necessarily deal with those cases. Clearly, if I was a judge, I'll be guided by the prosecutor. Certainly, the case is the facts of the case. Don't want to speak out of turn because I'm obviously not
right.
I don't have all of the facts. Obviously, there may be a reason why. I know that with respect to this cop, he has no history. He has no record. First time, so I get it. I just don't think probation is the right message, particularly, right, because you have to deal with the totality of the circumstances, whether you like it or not. We know what's going on in society. We know that a lot of African, brown-skinned people are getting killed by cops, arguably without cause. And so you have a situation where the guy's been filed guilty, right? He's been filed guilty. There's no, he wasn't filed in. He was filed guilty I just don't think that's the right thing. So I would, as a judge, if I had to deal with that, a prosecutor saying to me, I want to propose probation. One, judges are not necessarily, they're not required necessarily to follow the prosecutor recommendation. It's a recommendation, so they can do something different. But you have to consider all those facts. I would take that into account. But you certainly do not want to, you're dealing with a case, you want to deal with the case specifics. You don't necessarily look outside of the case. But gee whiz, Wayne, it's hard to make a decision like that, not taking into account all of the lives, particularly brown lives, that have been lost at the hands of officers. And look, when I talk to kids and these officers, I say to them, look, you're taking a chance. When you confront an officer and you don't sit there quietly and you don't follow instructions, can I tell all the kids that I know, do me a favor, listen, don't say anything, follow the instruction of the officer, because you're taking a chance and you're not dealing with a maniac. You're taking a chance that you're not dealing with someone who's just as scared as you are. Oftentimes, these officers are afraid. They're afraid. And because of the stereotypes, they're afraid of us. they believe the hype. They believe that every black kid they see has a gun. Every black kid they see is up to no good. It's shameful.
Right.
And so I tell the kids, listen, take that into account, whether you like it or not. Take that into account. So, that's a tough situation. I'm glad I'm not the judge on that case. But I tell you what, I'll be hard pressed to just deal with a recommendation of probation under those circumstances.
I feel the police department bears some responsibility in that. Wouldn't you think? Why would you send a rookie out, in an environment like that when notoriously, they're still learning. I don't know. Maybe I could be wrong about that.
You're trying to interject logic into a system that is not. It's the police department, and I'm not trying to disrespect any police department, law and order in any way, shape, or form. I'm kind of a law and order person, believing that we need to have law and order in a society. But when you realize that these guys, they don't get the training that they really should have in dealing with the public and having that, that's a job that's a much more important, a much more job, larger. It deserves more respect than it gets, as opposed to just being a security force. The cops are on the brutes come and smash heads,
right.
Beat up and ask questions later. And it really is a type of job. You're dealing with people. You're dealing with different types of people. You have to have a certain sensitivity. If you really talk about law and order, we know that the initial thing was the police. Obviously part of their job back in the day was catch slaves and bring slaves back and control black people. So we know that the history of the police force is one that has a rocky relationship as it pertains to African Americans and people of color. But I think that if we're going to give them the tools for society to help keep order in a society and keep the peace in society, they're peace officers, then we need to give them the tools. Let's not have the requirements being so low, so to the point where the idiot that you knew in high school or that was not really the tough guy or not really had no really identity, you get out of high school and 10 years later, this guy's a cop now, or the guys who barely were able to graduate, take a GED. I don't know what the educational requirement is to be a police officer. I don't think that it's a 4-year degree that's required. But so when
part of the problem, maybe.
Yeah, and then when you have a certain low expectation or a low benchmark that's set, you're going to get a certain level of individuals that are working for you. You're not going to get the best and the brightest.
But let's even take it a step further, because I'll say to you guys that part of the reason why I believe I'm an effective judge is because of my background, right? I grew up dirt poor in Harlem, raised by a single mom on welfare, right? So the sensitivity is there. So when I'm dealing with kids who look like me, similar background, I understand. I get it. So I deal with the circumstances that are confronting with me differently. So to your point, Eric, so whether it be, make it so that, officers need to go to college at minimum. But at the end of the day, we have to have a police force that looks like the environment that they're there to service. It is ridiculous to have a police force, and I don't know, let's just pick any municipality. I mean, a police force, you know, they're servicing a poor population, primarily black, you know, brown-skinned people. You look at their police force, and it's predominantly white. That doesn't make any sense. The sensitivity is not going to be there, because the one thing we don't put into the equation is that a lot of these officers are afraid, and they believe the stereotypes, right? So what I want to see more is a police force, whether it be East Orange, Montclair, wherever, that mirrors the neighborhood, the environment that they're there to service, so that the sensitivity is there. You know, they get it. They understand not every kid they come across is a bad kid, right? Yeah, there are a lot of kids who go to college who make mistakes, like I did. Give me a chance. So, you know, the sensitivity needs to be there. I would agree that I think, you know, maybe you increase the requirements so that, you know, you make these officers, I'm assuming it's not there because I don't really know what the requirements are, but you make it so that it's more than just a high school degree, right, for example. But at the end of the day, I mean, I think what we should be working towards is having police forces that mirror the neighborhood, the environment that they're there to service. I think that would go a long way in trying to, you know, do away with some of these, you know, some of these mishaps that we have with the police and the general public.
Right. Well, I think a bottom line really is kind of racism is still very prevalent in that. But also, I would also add, and I guess you can't make this a requirement, but I also think that they should live in a community, be for us and from the community.
Yeah.
Because then you have a vested interest. Then you have a stake. Then you're not looking at people, you know, and like you said, if they're of the community, and the community is predominantly one way or another, then they're going to look like, you know, members of people who live in the community. But also, one of the things is that there's no compassion when, like you said, when these people are basically occupying force, they come into an area, they secure the area, keep it, you know, under control or whatever. But there's no compassion, there's no empathy when they look and see a young black man, young black girl. I mean, if you look online and see these instances, these white cops throwing young girls down and manhandling them, white cops doing this to young girls of color, young teenage girls, and manhandling them like no one will want anyone to manhandle their daughter, there is no level of compassion. There's no humanity there when they're dealing with the people. So when you don't look at someone as being, you look at someone as being subhuman, as they've been taught, you know, that's been a problem in our country for years, then you're going to treat them as such. And so there's no problem. This security officer who happened to be a cop, so he's got no problem with throwing a young girl across the room. She was being, she was resisting his action, certainly, and I certainly believe that he needed to, you know, apply a little force, but that was excessive. And you have instances of a party, a pool party that got out of hand somewhere because some black kids lived in a development that was predominantly white, and a lot of kids showed up. Maybe some were invited, so it got kind of out of hand, and you got the situation with the cop on TV throwing a young black girl to the ground. So they have no compassion for our people. And until they learn compassion, or we force them to have compassion, or there is some consequence to your actions, then it's always going to happen. Just recently tonight, I saw another instance in, I forget, maybe it's in Texas, of a cop approaching a man and the brother ends up dead. But and they're finding, now there are two findings. There's one in Minnesota where one of the black where the young guy ended up dead because when his girl got taken away in the ambulance,
right,
apparently allegedly rushed a cop or whatever. This brother ended up dead. Now, recently today, I saw another clip. I didn't see the whole news clip, but a white cop shot a black guy that was holding a barbecue fork or something. Somehow the guy came and had this encounter, and the brother ends up dead. And the cop shoots him with a shotgun. But in the difference in the two scenarios is that in Minnesota, it was the authorities were white that were saying, we're not going to charge, we haven't found things to charge this cop. In the other instance, I saw the man at the podium, I assumed the chief of police was a black man. And he was saying, you know, well, it appears that the officer's actions were justified. You know, there was nothing out of the ordinary. But the actions still need to be investigated. So there's empathy there. There's understanding that this seems to be a systemic problem in the United States, where every time, not every time, because I've had encounters with police officers over the course of my life, I ended up dead. But there seems seems to be a systemic problem in the United States, and that is repeatedly that young black men, or old black men for that matter, because a guy just recently got killed, was in his 40s or 50s, seem to end up dead all the time. And in a lot of these instances on tape, we've seen, and certainly in South Carolina, where the cop tried to manipulate the murder scene and then start to make it so the guy ran and made up the lie that the brother turned or did whatever when he shot him in the back. So their credibility is not even is questionable now when they report these things. And so it's all about, like I said, being in the infrastructure. You have a black chief of police. Perhaps his perspective is going to be a little bit different than that white chief of police. And I'm not saying it's across the board, but there seems to be some way to level out the playing field, some way to show that if it's not what we think it is, help us to prove that it's not. And that needs to be incumbent upon, I believe, white law enforcement police officers. And we need to have more, like, there's, you know, you can look on just as many videotapes and YouTube clips of white cops that appear to be working in a predominantly black community that have great relationships with the community members. I saw one about a cop who really works well with the kids throughout the neighborhood. He does a lot of things with the kids. It's very encouraging. And this is, you know, this is good police. These are police officers who understand that the relationship with the community is paramount in keeping a law and order and being a peace officer. And, you know, so you have the good ones and the bad ones. Unfortunately, in the United States, racism has been so prevalent where it was illegal pretty much to be black, and the law, the order of the day was to keep black people in line. So you have those remnants, that leftover remnants, I believe, in a lot of police forces and a lot of places across the country. Clearly, you have that, or else we wouldn't have the situations that we have. So
I agree with you, Eric. I mean, the only thing, not to cut you off, that I find still a problem, you know, it's about the American culture. It's about getting people to understand uniformly, you know, we may have something that might be just totally relevant and germane to the city of New York or Newark or Montclair and places like that. But, you know, when you go into places like Houston and Dallas, and I remember driving cross-country from the Republican National Convention in San Diego back in 2000, and I got stopped in northern Texas. And I held my heart in my hand because this cop wanted to go through my trunk, and it was like 90-degree weather. I wasn't doing anything wrong, but I knew I didn't fit the profile of what he was looking for. And, you know, thank God I had a microphone, my tape recorder, and my credentials on me, or else I probably would have done time in jail that day. And I think it's, a lot of it goes back to behavior modification. And I also think there's some people on the force who look like us who need to get the same message as well. Because,
right.
You know, I think that, too, is a problem.
Right. Look, I tend not to necessarily look at it white and black, although some things are obviously that, so I get it. I'm not suggesting otherwise. But to your point, Wayne, a lot of it is really do the right thing, right, whether you're black or white. Listen, I've come across officers of color who have been worse to me than any white officer would be to me, right? So, you know, we have these positions of authority where we need to be mindful that we need to put people in these places where they have empathy in a search point, or at least have an understanding that not everyone is out there to do bad. And even when you do bad, you know, people deserve a break. I mean, I just think that the sensitivity needs to be there, whether you're white or black. And listen, I've come across, you know, officers of color who, I'm telling you, who are worse than anyone could be. You know what I mean? And I find that to be interesting, too. So my thing when I treat the kids is do not put yourself in that situation. And if you do, stay quiet. You know, don't say much. Make sure you say you want to speak to your parent or have them call an attorney. But certainly, you know, I don't want to say be obedient, because that certainly is not what I want to say. But certainly don't mouth off, because you're taking a chance that you're dealing with a level-headed cop. Most cops are scared and nervous. And to Ernest's point, you may have a cop who's just not right.
Right.
He's not right. Black or white. Mm-hmm. And now because of social media, because of cell phones and what have you, we're starting to see things on tape. But could you imagine 20, 30 years ago, what was going on?
Oh.
I mean, can you imagine? I mean, I just think about, you know, poor people back then who had to deal with, had no recourse. There was no video, there's no tape. And oftentimes you do give officers credibility. And, you know, it's just, it, to me, I think of those circumstances, it makes me really sad. So when I try to tell kids, is, look, don't put yourself in that situation. And if you are, please, you know, follow the instructions of the officer. I try to tell them, get home. You know, you'll go that night, you get home. You know, don't make it worse by mouthing off. Even if you're right, you know, get home. So that's the message of the day. Confront authority, get home. And oftentimes if you know, people say to me, but, you know, what are you saying? I say, no, look, you come across an officer, you know, you can be respectful to the point where you kind of discard them. You bring their guards down when you're so respectful. They can't be nothing but respectful back. You know, oftentimes you come across someone, particularly if you did nothing wrong, and you're offensive. I tell them, don't be offensive. You know, just try to get through the day, be respectful, live, you know, get home so then we can deal with it another day.
Right. You don't want to give them any
Exactly.
You don't want to give the cops any reason to go take it any further. But let's kind of move the conversation back to the last 13, 14 minutes we have about the political thing and with the Trumps and the Kasich thing, because I wrote that as a description for the show, so I want to make sure we talk about
that. And
Wayne, let me ask you, because you're over there in the city, obviously, in New York or Westchester. When you're out and about, what is the tone? And do you find a lot of people, are you able to sense that a lot of people are supportive of Donald Trump? Because I tend to feel that those of us that live in this tri-state area, New York, Connecticut, and New Jersey, we've all gone through the Trump act, you know, his whole act. We've all seen it before, and we all are just
right.
You know, and the rest of the country hasn't seen it before. To them, he's the celebrity guy, and you know, there's a certain amount of that, and he's a rich guy. Obviously, we worship wealth in this country because people do that, and also the nationalism appealing to the white nationalism in a lot of people. But I'm just wondering if New Yorkers, rank and file, I can imagine that there are certain white individuals that are probably supporting him, and you know, but I'm just wondering if rank and file, when you run across people, is there a large support for Donald Trump that you're able to sense over there?
I tell you, Eric and Judge, I one of the things that really I'm missing out in this particular political season is the fervor and the, you know, back in 2007, 2008, when Obama was running, once it became clear that this was a viable candidate, you know, I just got this sense that, you know, people were really concerned about, you know, his becoming the first black president. In this situation here with Trump, obviously, it's particularly if you go into the Latino community, voter registration in those areas have been high. And I know that the agenda is not, at least I would like to think that their agenda is not to vote Republican, you know? And
yeah.
And I think it's an embarrassment with what has gone on with the two Republican candidates of Cuban descent trying to outwhite each other. But be that as it may, at least one is gone. And the thing is that you talk about Trump, I guess it depends on who you talk to. I have a tax guy, somebody new that I've been dealing with the last couple of years, and he's an older gentleman, and he's a Republican, and he sees the parasites coming out of each party. But for some reason, he mentioned something the other day that hit home, and he realizes that Trump is not socially equipped to hold the office. But he said, during the course of the early debates, he was struck by the sympathy or the understanding that he had, that Trump had for Ben Carson, the neurosurgeon who, you know, disbanded his campaign because it wasn't going anywhere after a couple of after the last couple of caucuses, and you know, and he said the other candidates, including your Governor Christie, who was still a player at the time, did not take any interest in trying to elevate this man's cause, you know? And the thing is that All right, that's one area where he may be somewhat sympathetic. And then you have the rationale, and I'm quoting Geraldo Rivera, who's also someone I question in terms of integrity, saying, well, he's a product of the 50s and 60s, and white kids that he grew up with acted just like Donald Trump, and you just have to ignore or understand that it's not meant as an act of racism. But, I mean, the thing is, Trump has come out and said things, took money out of his pocket to have articles published, you know, showing his opinion about the Central Park Five. There's a 1991 quote in which he said he would rather have people walking around with yarmulkes on counting his money than blacks. You know, I'm not making this up. There's a whole website devoted to his racism. So I don't know what more to say.
Geraldo's an idiot, first off. We know that Geraldo's a sellout idiot. And he, he came about, you know, he had the show back in the air, Good Morning, Good Night America. He was kind of hippie, kind of, he was on that cusp of that movie because he's of that generation. And he completely sold out to become, you know, I guess the money is good when obviously you're a conservative and Republican, but, or whether you choose to go on that side. But, I mean, he's right. I grew up with white kids like that, too. Talk like Donald Trump and some, you know, come off politically incorrect or whatever, and some I'm going to be cool with, but some I'm not going to be cool with. But here's the thing about that. You don't ignore it. Yeah, you just don't deal with the ones, you either tell them you check them, and you don't deal with people who claim to be friends and comfortable with you that are going to be using the N-word around you or going to be saying stuff constantly about your skin color, which some would do. The ones who are really your friends aren't going to do that. And the ones who aren't, you let them know and say, okay, that's funny, and then you let them know a couple of times, and you snap back on them, and just point blank let them know. If that's going to be the way we're going to relate, then we're going to be fighting. You know, so what Geraldo says is just ignoring it. You know, you don't ignore it. Those people aren't your friends. If they say, like, for instance, I just went back and forth with someone that reached out to me on Facebook. I didn't reach out to this guy, but him and his brother, I was friends with his brother. They grew up around the corner from me in Maplewood. So I posted this clip of President Obama performing, not really performing, but pulling his cards with the lead actor, the creator of Hamilton. And the kind of like every card had a phrase on it, and this guy or a word, and the dude was making up the raps as he went along, right? And they had like a Marine drummer in the background hitting the beat. And I was like, I put the post up and said, this is the coolest president, or is our president not the coolest president? Now, a lot of white people that I went to school with now that are grown now are Trump supporters, and we've fallen into our roles as white and black adults in America, right? And so this guy, the guy's brother, I was more friends with his brother, but he reached out to me, accept him as a friend on Facebook. He left a quote on my thing, said, this song sucks and so does the president. So I was like, I hit him back. I was like, who are you and why are you even leaving stuff on my page? And then I realized, oh, you're so-and-so, John's brother. I said, well, don't leave. I said, but the same thing stands. Don't leave an asshole remark on my page. what I usually try, and he hit something back, sorry that it upsets you. I said in my response to him, I understand everybody's entitled to their opinion. What I usually try to do, if one of my friends says something that I don't agree with, I have the good grace not to say anything instead of leaving an asshole remark. So he came back, sorry, it came across my page. Somehow it came across his page, so he commented. And, you know, sorry, you know, it hurt your feelings or whatever. You know, it's freedom of speech in America. And I hit him back, and I said, yeah, it is. You're right, as I said. And I said, I really would expect from me and you, you know, growing up, I expect that from some guys we grew up with, but not you and your brother. We always had a different level of recourse. So I had to educate homie on really how we're going to relate. And if we disagree about the president, if you've fallen into being, I'm going to be pro-white man now that you've grown up and all this stuff, don't bring that to me. You know, I mean, let's agree to disagree, because some of my friends are Republicans and they, you know, they're on that tip and right on. But they have the good grace not to, if I put something up, they're not going to come off and leave something
you.
Like, basically, like you want to leave something nasty, like you want to, that you want to step to me, you know, and that's how I am. I'm the type to break it down. I don't remember you being a tough guy. So, you know, don't leave stuff on that you're not willing to back up what you say in person. But,
wow.
You know, I wanted to keep him friendly and let him know it's not really about us combating this way. And I left it to, like, on with the debate. I told him I'm up for a debate about Barack Obama anytime you want. You know, these are people that know our family history, know where we are. So he doesn't want to have that kind of debate.
Yeah, but the problem is you can't. I mean, what I've learned is, and again, being a judge, I shouldn't talk about politics. But the one thing I learned is, you know, you can never have a really good conversation when you're talking about our president, because people are still annoyed that they, you know, we have a black guy as a president. I mean, and once you understand and appreciate that, I mean, think about it. The Republican Party has spent a better part of 8 years doing everything they could to block everything President Obama wanted to do.
Exactly.
Everything. I mean, so when you see that, there's no way I can have a legitimate conversation with anyone opposed to Obama, because we know it's not coming from a objective, just, you know, because one thing, if we don't agree on how we should get something done. You know, there are people who believe in the conservative movement. There are people who are more liberal. I get it. So we can have conversation, but when it's just straight up, outright, unfair, or, you know, some argue racist, well, I'm not even going to bother to have that conversation, because you're not going to get anywhere with that. You're just not.
I mean, and as you know, Wayne, I mean, you know, when you're dealing with people, when you and my mom are at WLIB, you know, you have those people who just have a certain perspective, and they're never going to understand or their perspective colors how they look at the world. They're not able to be objective. And you also have people, what always used to trip me out about you guys on LIB is that you always would have, I know my mom had at least one of those white listeners that would listen to the black radio station just to see what the black people were talking about.
Exactly.
And then call up the show and say, you know, I didn't want to say, it's like, why are you worried about what we're talking about?
Right,
you know,
right. Well,
they
would listen to your mother and then call Bob Grant and talk about what, you know, I don't even want to say what they would refer to us as, but the people
right,
of color,
right.
That station, you know, what they
right.
were saying. I mean, it's just sad.
But
this
mean,
is America.
That's the sickness. The obsession with what are they talking about? What that, you know, that was the rule, like why you could never, the loitering rule, you know, when two or three black people getting together, more than one, they start calling it a mob, a gang or whatever, because they don't want cats, you know, that was, you know, against, didn't want too many slaves to get together and start thinking and conspiring to do something. You know, that was the law back then. You know, they wanted the slaves to get there and start talking. They start talking about coming up with ideas. So it's kind of like that, you know, what are they talking about? What are they planning? What, you know, and it's that conscience, I believe, guilt. You feel guilty. And I think that
yeah.
when you discuss slavery and racism, a lot of people, white people who happen to be white, they feel guilty. As if you're accusing them initially, you know, like it's a direct, like, you know, and I've had white friends say, well, my family never owned slaves. I never owned slaves. Of course you did. But, you know, a lot of people break it down that why, you know, white America and white people have benefited from the institution of slavery in the United States. And you don't want the white people to about it, but you also want them to at least acknowledge that this is taking place. And a lot of them, the reason we fall down in these discussions is that there's a refusal to agree that this has at least taken place in America is not what is cracked up.
Honestly, they should even the playing field. I mean, there are still people who don't appreciate it. They have gotten certain advantages because they're non-black or non-brown.
Right.
And again, when you hear that, then I can't have a honest discussion with people because they're not being objective about the topic. So, Kevin.
Right.
We've been talking for a long time. It's flown by. We got under 60 seconds. Wayne, what do you want to say before you get out there?
I just want to say it's always an honor and to talk to Judge Benitez. It's like he's inspired me. I feel lazy at 60-something, you know, when I look at his credentials. But as soon as I could steal some money out here, I intend to try to see if I could at least become a paralegal, you know, something like that. You know,
there you go.
I'm really impressed with you, sir. As you, Eric, and as all,
right.
and all the pains, you know.
I
stood in the wrong line.
Say goodbye. Say goodbye, Wayne.
Okay, good night.
All right. Well, thanks, everybody, for listening to the K-Thompson Live Show on Blog Talk Radio. Thank you, Wilfredo Benitez.
Thank you for having me, Eric. I really appreciate it. Thank you, Wayne. Thank you for the kind words.
For everybody, you can listen to us every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m., or the show is archived, blogtalkradio.com/KTompsonLive. We'll see you again next week.